I guarantee you, you will start communicating with your animal doing these simple kinds of things.
Huh. I know when they growl what they're trying to tell me, but not exactly some of the other things they're doing.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for joining us.
We're kicking off today's show with two very important topics, dollars and sex.
Ooh, yeah. We'll hear how economic theories can be applied to matters of love and libido.
I've got my pen and pad already.
Also in this hour, a Bahamian woman's inspiring story, from poverty to the Hospitality Hall of Fame.
Then a boomer dives into college life and pledges a frat.
Plus survival tips for caretakers.
And the genius behind the iconic Etch-A-Sketch. We babes never thought of economics as a sexy science. That is, until we heard about Dr. Marina Adshade. She taught a course at the University of British Columbia called The Economics of Sex and Love, where she encouraged students to apply economic theories to matters of love and libido. Needless to say, this professor's course was standing room only.
Well, the hit class turned into a hit blog, and it became the basis for her book, Dollars and Sex, How Economics Influences Sex and Love. Marina Adshade joins us on the phone from Vancouver to share some of her surprising findings. Great to have you with us.
Oh, it's such a pleasure to be here.
How on earth did you get the idea to couple economics and sex together in a course?
So the idea is to put together a course that taught students the basic economic tools that they need, but did it using a subject that they could relate to their own lives and that they found a little bit more engaging. And it was very effective for that. My students showed up and they paid attention and they were never looking at their phones during my class. That was really the goal of the class. And then once I started teaching it, I realized that it had broader interest to people outside of my class and in terms of just giving economic tools, and that's when I started writing the blog.
Well, it's a genius. So do you think it's a little bit cold to view sex and love through an economic lens? It makes romance seem a wee bit calculated.
I like to think about this, if I can use an analogy, is that I like French cheese. I think I have like an emotional, physical relationship with French cheese. But that doesn't mean that I can't use economics to explain my cheese purchases and how prices of cheese affect the way I buy cheese or my income or my preferences. And so I think thinking about love and relationships is the same way. Really what I'm trying to do is to describe the markets and help people understand the markets. I think that it would be cold if I was saying to people, here's a bunch of economic tools, and you should be using these tools to choose a person that you have a relationship with. Please ignore all of your preferences around love and companionship. I mean, that's not really the purpose. The purpose is really just to lend some clarity to the choices that we ourselves make.
Well, it makes so much sense.
I'm not the first person to talk about the markets for love or the marriage markets or the meat markets. I mean, people have been using these terms for years. And so I think we do understand that when we're looking for love, we are operating on markets and we're subject to market forces, just like anything else might be subject to market forces.
Let's talk about some of your findings. One is that marriage, when viewed through an economics lens, is mostly an opportunity just to consume more. What do you mean by that?
In the past, marriage was seen by economists as operating like a mini firm where we're all, you know, workers in the firm, and so marriage was optimal. I think that marriage has really changed, and I think there's a lot of consensus on this, and that is because, you know, now we don't have the same division of responsibilities between home and work that we had in the past. And so now marriage is more about consumption. For example, housing costs are a lot cheaper when you're married to someone. A lot of expenses are, and it's not just in terms of making your expenses less, your consumption less expensive, but I think that also makes your consumption more pleasurable because you have somebody to share these experiences with. You know, it's much more pleasant to, you know, spend 2 weeks in Italy with your spouse, somebody that you're in a relationship with, than it is on your own. And I think marriage is very much like that. And then this is why I think people continue to marry and why people will continue to marry in the future.
Well, and then those of us who are married know that we are kind of constantly bargaining and negotiating with our spouse, but you say that's a good thing.
I think that bargaining and negotiating is a natural part of marriage because that's how decisions are made. I mean, let's face it, no couple is going to completely 100% agree on everything that they do. And so that means that to some extent there has to be bargaining. How decisions are made depends on how bargaining power is distributed within the couple. So, you know, if you're in a relationship with somebody who, whenever you have a disagreement on something that you're going to do, if they always get their own way, then they hold all the bargaining power. If it's always a 50-50 chance that you're going to get your own way, then the bargaining power is split. And what's interesting about that is that bargaining power has changed over time. And I think that we realize this, that the fact that women have outside options, that they're working more outside of the home and they're better educated, it is giving women more bargaining power in their relationships. And that's changing the structure of marriage as we know it.
And surprisingly, there are actually economic costs associated with a woman taking her husband's name.
When women take their husband's name and they apply for jobs, the person who's considering them for the position find that women who've taken their husband's names are less attached to the workforce, are more committed to home and family than they are to the workplace, and as a result, they're offered lower starting salary wages than women who keep their own name after marriage. Those women are seen as harder working, more motivated, and actually get paid higher starting salaries. And many women say to me, well, that's okay, because my future employer is not going to have any idea that I changed my name. But of course, in a time in which so many employers ask for school transcripts, it's actually pretty obvious that you've changed your name.
So what if we hyphenate the names?
I don't know about
happy
hyphenating.
Medium, huh?
Yeah.
I would think that hyphenating might be the same as not sending it. Not changing it. So that might be a good happy medium.
Or I use my maiden name as my middle name.
Yes.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Yeah. Let me ask you about people that aren't married and that are living together before marriage. You found that they might be in an economic disadvantage. So tell us about that one.
We've known for a long time that people who live together before they get married are more likely to divorce. It's interesting because it's actually they're not only more likely to divorce, but they're actually more likely to accumulate less wealth over time. And that's because people who cohabit before marriage are in general are less committed to the relationship, and that means that they're less willing to, you know, pool their resources for savings and so on. But what's really interesting about that is that there's a big difference between people who've live together just with one person with the purpose of marrying. Say that you're a college student and you plan on marrying your significant other as soon as you're finished school, but you're living together in the meantime. Those people actually are exactly the same as people who don't live together before they're married. The big difference is in people who are serial cohabitators, people who've had like two or three relationships where they lived with somebody without marrying them. That's when you start seeing the negative effects. And cohabitators are actually interesting and much more likely to cheat outside their relationships than are people who are married.
You're tuned into the Two Boomer Babes Radio Hour. We are looking at sex and love through an economist's lens. Our guest is Dr. Marina Adshade. Her book is called Dollars and Sex. Now, this one really got us. Tell us about why shorter men tend to have younger wives.
What happens is that taller men are harder commodities on the market when they're younger. And so they're more likely to match up and marry at a younger age, whereas shorter men are more likely to marry later. I mean, this is not just speculation. This is very apparent in the data that there's a big divide. And because shorter men marry later, they're more financially stable, higher income when they do finally marry. And because of that, they actually manage to attract younger wives. So on average, shorter men marry later, but they marry younger women.
I always thought it was rich men that marry younger women.
Rich men do marry younger women as well. And so they're shorter rich men who are marrying younger women.
Yeah. And then there's another fascinating tidbit in your book. You say that there's a lesbian wage gap where you found that lesbians earn more than straight women. So can you explain that one?
They do, and this is pretty well documented, that lesbians on average earn about 12 to 15% more than straight women do. After you control for things like the number of children they have or their education or their occupation. What's interesting is if you take women who are lesbians and you separate out women who have never been in a heterosexual marriage, that actually reduces the wage gap. And the explanation for that is that women who are heterosexual reasonably anticipate that when they marry, they'll be married to somebody who earns more than themselves. And that's because the gender wage gap persists and men make consistently more than women do. But women who are lesbians can't anticipate that. They're just as likely to end up with somebody who earns less than them as they are to be with somebody who earns more than them. And so what it seems is the wage gap is at least partially explained by the idea that lesbian women just apply themselves more consistently to their careers because they plan on working over their whole lives and supporting themselves and possibly end up supporting somebody else in the future.
Now, so many people these days are looking for love online. But you say we might actually be making it harder to find a mate by doing that. Why is that?
You know, looking for love online from a purely market perspective really is a good thing because it broadens your markets. It makes more people available to you. And so people on average, actually, they might end up searching a little bit longer online because they actually have a better hope of finding somebody who's their perfect mate. You know, I always like to say that we're only like two generations away from looking for our marriage partners in our high school graduating class. So we really have had the market opened up to us. The interesting thing is that when we go and look at how people actually search, and women actually do this more than men, is that they start to narrow their parameters. So, for example, say that I was at a party and I was looking for somebody. I might just meet somebody and have this experiential exchange with them where I find out what they're like before eliminating them as a potential partner. I certainly wouldn't walk up to them and say, I don't know, you look like you're 5'5 instead of 5'6. I'm not going to talk to you. But online people do this all the time. And I think that's just because there's so many people there. People try to narrow their searches in any way they can, narrowing over height or weight or income or ethnicity. And we wouldn't just do that. We wouldn't do this in the real world.
Right. We wouldn't have a checklist, basically.
No, you wouldn't, right?
Right. Well, Marina, you have some really, really interesting ways to predict an economic downturn. What are they?
Economists are always looking at ways of predicting recessions, and so we look for what we call leading indicators of recessions. And for a long time, people talked about lipstick as a leading indicator of a recession because it's an inexpensive way for women to make themselves feel good about themselves and maybe in the face of economic uncertainty. Well, you know, it's 2013, and you're seeing more of things like an increase in lubricants and sex toys in the lead-up to the recession. So I think that indicates that people are looking for, you know, cheap ways to have fun at home instead of going out and spending more, maybe for a date night, and that's driving up sales. And it was really quite remarkable in the lead-up to the last recession.
Uh-huh.
And then, of course, coming out of the recession, we have the exact opposite effect, that there's an increase in demand for boob jobs and facelifts. You know, these things appear to be cyclical.
Well, we understand that you're single. So as an economist, and after writing this book, do you tend to view every suitor in economic terms? I mean, do you kind of size them up, you know, that way? Or are you really a romantic at heart?
I know, I'm really romantic at heart.
Oh, you're a pushover.
I mean, I do think about these things in terms of my own market. For example, I'm conscious of not limiting my own market the way that we tend to do. And I'm conscious about not overvaluing myself on the market because that limits your options so much. So I think about it from that perspective. But certainly when I meet a man, you know, I'm just as interested in the, you know, emotional, biological, physical connection as any other woman. I'm actually a bit of a softy for somebody who writes about this topic as in a way that so many people describe as being cold. And I think that comes through in the book, though.
It does. You can't put a price on love, right?
No, you can't. You definitely cannot.
Economist Marina Anshade, author of Dollars and Sex. This discussion has put romance in a whole new perspective, I must say. Thanks so much for joining the Two Boomer Babes.
Up next, from humble beginnings to hotel icon, a Bahamian shares her story.
Support comes from Accent on Travel, Rehoboth Beach, with a Viking Rhine River cruise with us, the Two Boomer Babes. For questions and reservations, 302-703-6154.
Bailey Chase offers a lifestyle of flexibility and choice that provides you new opportunities to experience your independence and enrich your life. For more information about the lifestyle Bailey Chase offers, visit www.integrace.org. Equal housing opportunity.
If you've ever traveled to the Bahamas or plan to, there's a chance you've heard the name Nettie Simonette. She rose from humble beginnings and a challenging childhood to launch one of the most successful business enterprises in the Bahamas. She tells it all in her memoir, A Girl Called Nettie. She joins us from Nassau to share What her friend, the fabulous actor Sean Connery, said is without question the most moving and intriguing story of a life fully lived and still going. Welcome, Nettie.
Well, it's my pleasure. Welcome.
Nettie, you're nearing your 80th birthday, and you certainly haven't let gender or age stop you in any way. And you've built this kind of mini empire in the Bahamas with your hotel. So can you let us in on your secret, please?
Girls, it's all about hard work, discipline, determination, willing to work, just embracing every opportunity.
Now, are you still at the helm and working every day in the hotel?
I am still here, but I've reached this age and stage in my life now where all I want to do now is the creative cooking. I love to cook. And the art and the writing and the cultural, the historical part of it, that's what I'm focused on now in my life.
Nettie, how did you ever get the idea to actually start a hotel?
Many years ago, back in 1954, I entered the hotel industry going in from the back door in those days. And then on the second day, I was in through the front door. But then as I moved on up the right, because then I opened the Holiday Inn on Paradise Island, and I remember the Washington Times reporter came along, and I made a statement that one day I hoped to own a hotel of my own, even if it's only 10 rooms. So I worked so hard for the other man, and I felt that if I could make the other man so successful, I can do it for myself.
You are very open in your book, and life wasn't exactly a bowl of cherries when you were growing up. You're one of 10 children. Your family home was even confiscated, and even at one point your mom fled, I think for fear of her own life, with a little brother. Who was the constant in your life?
I was the fourth child. Well, ever since I was a little girl, 8 years old, that's like my mother's age. We had the shop, we had the business, and she entrusted me with running the business. So at age 11, I'm teaching. I became a little businesswoman at a very early age in my life. And then, of course, you know, she and I had the kind of closeness that none of the others had. And then, of course, you know, she found herself in a situation where she ran her life and she left everything behind. And then I was in and I sacrificed everything for her. But I have no regrets. It's the greatest thing I could have done in my life.
Wow. We understand you have 7 kids yourself, and we hear they are all fabulous and thriving. And you raised them as a single mom, no less. That must have not have been easy.
I thank God I've had an opportunity because my children, they range from age 50, age 47 to 56. And I tell you, they're the most wonderful human beings in this world, and not one of them have ever taken me before the man. That's the courts or the laws or anything. It's not easy for me, and I taught my children values at a very early age in life, that life is not going to be a bowl of cherries and priorities sorting out. And having manners and respect for everyone and doing your best and giving your all, and if you do that in life, you know, you can only succeed.
You have certainly met a lot of celebrities along the way. And besides Sean Connery, who we just drool over, who was your favorite guest, if you can even narrow it down?
The one that fascinated me the most was John Grisham. I was very, very fascinated when he came to visit me at my place in Abaco. He seemed like a little shy boy. He had this cap turned back in the front. I don't want anyone to know who I am, blah, blah. And then it took him like one day to really take that cap back. And then he discovered how good my cooking was. And he came for fishing. But then I found out by the end of day one, it was not about the fishing. He wanted to find out, well, Nettie, what are you going to feed me tonight? What are you going to feed me? It was just such a wonderful experience. But then, of course, all of my guests were absolutely wonderful.
And is Sean Connery as dashing and dapper as he seems?
When he calls and speak to me, I was very shocked he calls me. And my daughter, Shirley, he calls and he says, Sean Connery here. Can we please speak with my Nettie? And I just get so fascinated. And I tell him about how when we take this boat ride back for the Paris Island, when they were doing the movie Thunderball. And then, of course, I just sit there and just watch all these beautiful girls swoon all over him and this sort of thing, you know. And I tell him about that. He sort of blush along the way.
Nettie, what attracts tourists to your hotels?
Let me say, in the past, it's like we were like a family operation. It's that personalized service and a family operation. You come here no matter what part of the world you come from, and you feel very much at home. And it's our laid-back culture and that sort of thing.
Well, finally, Nettie, we have to ask you, it doesn't sound like it, but do you have any plans to retire in the near future?
I retired doing what I want to do. I want to cook, like creative cooking, forever dreaming, building castles in the air still, enhancing the environment, and trying to have the world, my people in the world, appreciate our culture, who we are, and that sort of thing. When I retire from that, I mean, I'd be in the box. But it's a wonderful way to go out into the sunset because you're doing something very positive for the environment, for yourself, for your country, and the world.
Nettie, you're an inspiration. Nettie Simonette, Bahamian hotel icon and author of A Girl Called Nettie. Thanks so much for sharing your really inspiring story with the two boomer babes.
Well, thank you, Kathy and Barbara. You're just absolutely wonderful yourself. I admire you.
Well, I think Kathy and I have to start planning our trip to the Bahamas, Nettie.
Please be my guest whenever you come. I want you to come and stay with me.
We'd love it.
And let me cook some good old cooking for you.
Ooh, that'd be the best.
Fabulous. Up next, a boomer heads to college and goes Greek. We'll be right back.
This episode of Two Boomer Babes is sponsored by OnePriceTaxes.com.
Life is full of surprises. Filing your taxes shouldn't be.
OnePriceTaxes has been making online taxes easy, accurate, and affordable since 2007.
States' returns are included for free, and unlike other filing sites, there are no hidden fees
guaranteed. The old adage, when one door closes, another one opens, doesn't always apply as we grow older. Our options seem to narrow, especially when it comes to our personal and professional lives. Often that proverbial door appears permanently closed.
But not for Jerry Reed. At age 69, he's fulfilling his dream of going to college, and get this, he joined a fraternity. Jerry is speaking with us by phone from the historic University of Virginia in Charlottesville, where he will be graduating next year. Great to have you with us. What took you so long? Why didn't you go to college right after high school?
I was a complete screw-up in high school. I was a rebel with no cause, and a friend of mine in Richmond from Thomas Jefferson High School, I went to John Marshall, he brought me to UVA. He taught me how to put leather patches on my elbows. He introduced me to the university, and he poked his finger in my chest and said, "You need to go to school here. You're wasting your life." And I didn't listen to him at that juncture. Instead, I joined him in the revelry of being a mascot for Chi Phi fraternity for about 5 years.
Jerry, tell us, what overall has your experience been like as on the campus?
Hey, if you're ready to get a hanky out, I can tell you that it's the most marvelous experience that an old guy could ever have. When I first got here, I didn't know what to do because I came in mid-year and didn't have the normal orientation, but I found out about the Jefferson Literary and Debating Society, and I went into a competitive process of interview, and I was chosen one of 20 out of 200 to join that organization founded in 1825, and it socialized me to grounds immediately, and the wonderful young men and women I've been privileged to hang out with while being at this university has been marvelous.
Jerry, not only did you go to college at age 69, you joined a fraternity. So why did you decide to go Greek?
The fellow who brought me up here and pointed out the error of my ways and also gave me a taste from the outside of what fraternity life was, Bill Sturman, he was a Chi Phi, and he passed away tragically in an automobile accident in 84. So I wanted to honor his memory, and I wanted to become a brother and a brother eternal of his. So I was able to do that by initiating. I did not have to pledge. I did not have to rush. And then I enjoyed a traditional part of the Greek experience in the first semester, and now I backed away to what we call a semi-alumni status.
Also, Jerry, we understand that you actually met your wife at a Chi Phi party way back when, I guess in the 60s.
Yes.
How did she feel about you going to college, you know, more than four decades later and pledging a fraternity? All those girls and
yeah.
those parties.
Yeah.
She was a little cynical about some of that. She said, "I will not live in a dormitory with you, and you will not be allowed to pledge a fraternity." Well, I found a way around that by not pledging. But she is on board with this whole thing. And we attended semi-formal date night, and we also attended Studio 54 night. And we had a blast. We went early and left early so we wouldn't get our shoes stuck to the floor. The acceptance has been, people tell me, "Mr. Reed, you're just one of us."
Do your frat brothers, do they view you more as a father figure, or do they treat you as one of the guys?
Once I started showing them that I really knew how to get down with my dance moves and had a cheer going in the house at Studio 54 night, they were more than willing to accept me as an equal.
Jerry, do you have any advice for a boomer going to college for the first time or returning after many years? I mean, you're certainly a success story here.
This is my first ever degree, and someone once said, "You're just going back to relive your glory days." And I said, "No, sir, I'm not. These are my glory days. It's my first ever college experience."
What's your major?
Humanities as a concentration and creative writing, and I hope to do some graduate work after I get my undergraduate studies done. Creative writing, because I'm working on three fiction works right now simultaneously.
Of course you are. And you're in many clubs too, Jerry. Don't whitewash it. Really? Brag a little.
Yeah. I can't. I have. They give me, the students here give me energy, and I use it.
And Jerry, we have to ask, are you getting good grades?
I'm carrying a 3.55 right now, and a 3.7 is on the horizon, so I think I'm holding my own, unlike my very, very poor high school performance. This is not difference night and day.
Well, we hope you'll go out
Phi Beta Kappa.
I want to wear all the sashes and ribbons I can get.
Jerry Reed, proud member of the University of Virginia. You are one inspiring boomer dude. Don't have too much fun at that school now.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. Up next, survival tips for caretakers with a dose of good humor.
Bailey Chase offers a lifestyle of flexibility and choice that provides you new opportunities to experience your independence and enrich your life. For more information about the lifestyle Bailey Chase offers, visit www.integrace.org. Equal housing opportunity.
Support comes from Accent on Travel Rehoboth Beach with a Viking Rhine River cruise with us, the two Boomer Babes. For questions and reservations, 302-703-6154. Do you remember Dr. Doolittle, the beloved fictional character who had the ability to speak with the animal kingdom? While this may have seemed like a bit of a stretch in 1967, biologist and Fulbright scholar Dr. Khan Slobachkov believes that the whole animal world is talking. We humans just don't know how to listen.
Dr. Khan and his team have spent decades studying the language of animals, a language he says communicates complicated information about food, predators, squabbles, and even petty jealousies. He's the author of Chasing Dr. Doolittle and joins us on the phone from beautiful Sedona, Arizona. Welcome to the show, Dr. Khan.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And thank you for allowing us to call you Dr. Khan. I really appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome.
So why is it so important that we understand what the animal kingdom has to say? I mean, I don't listen to my husband, much less those animals.
Well, it's important to listen because animals are talking to each other and they're trying to make themselves understood. Let me tell you a story about my early life and how I came to this. I always loved animals, and I wished that I could talk to them to find out what their lives were like. But there was a problem. How do you communicate with them? This problem was forcefully brought to my attention early in my life. I was born in China and learned to speak Russian fluently. But when I came to this country at the age of 5 and was put into the school system, all I could speak was Russian. And suddenly, I was in the same place as the animals. My teachers couldn't speak to me, and I couldn't speak to them. And my teachers made assumptions about my intelligence and ability to speak simply because they couldn't communicate with me. And now, I was in the same place that the animals were, with people making assumptions about animals simply because they couldn't communicate with them. And much later, I was exposed to the attitude of many scientists, linguists, and philosophers that animals are not capable of having any language. But, and does this sound familiar? I still remember thinking, I want to communicate with my animals, but how can I if they can't understand me and I don't know what to do to fix it? So when you're reading chapters 1 to 3 of Chasing Dr. Doolittle, you'll learn to redefine your definition of the words communication and language. And as you shift your perception, you'll gain the insight of how to move through the maze of barriers that have been set up to make us think that animals can't have language. For example, I have lizards living on the front porch of my house. And these lizards do head bobs, they do push-ups, they raise their legs, they raise their tails, and they communicate with each other using a form of grammar. When I go out there, I can do head bobs with my head. I can raise my torso, I can raise my arms up and down, and I communicate with them. They respond to me. We don't know what we're saying. I don't know what I'm saying in lizard language, and I can't understand them. But it's the beginning of the first step to try to communicate with other animals.
Well, Dr. Khan, then what is your definition of communication when it comes to animals?
We have communication and we have language. Communication is simply the transfer of the message. So, like a cell phone is a communication device. You speak into it, it transfers the message to another cell phone, and that's it. There's nothing that goes beyond the transfer of a message. Language, on the other hand, involves flexibility. It involves the intention to send a message. It involves novelty in the production of messages, and it involves structure such as grammar. So all of those kinds of things have to go into language, and this is what my book, Chasing Dr. Doolittle, shows that animals are capable of doing, and they're doing all of the time. They're flexible in the way that they use the signals that they produce. They have a toolbox of signals that they can decide to use in different contexts. They intend to send messages, they can produce novel messages, and they have a definite structure to the messages, just like we have a grammar in our own language.
Well, let's talk about the years that you spent studying the prairie dog, which, by the way, is actually a rodent, correct? Not a dog, as we know a dog. And you found that they really have a lot to say, including different words and sounds for predators. How do they know the difference, and how do they distinguish? What are the sounds that they make that are so that they define who they're talking about?
When I first started working with prairie dogs, which was about 25 years ago, we knew that prairie dogs make alarm calls to predators. It sounds like a little chirp. And people thought that every alarm call was exactly the same as every other alarm call. So it was just like an ah that we make when we're frightened by something. But once I started recording these alarm calls, once I started analyzing them statistically, once I started setting up experiments with these, I found that every alarm call was not like every other alarm call, that they had different calls for different species of predators. So they had a call for a coyote, they had a call for a hawk, they had a call for a human, they had a call, amazingly enough, for a domestic dog that looks just like a coyote but is a dog. And doing further experiments, I found that not only do they have these calls for different predators, but they can actually describe the physical features of each individual predator. So for humans, they can describe your size and shape. They can describe the color of clothes that you're wearing. They can describe your speed of travel. They can even describe whether you're carrying a gun.
Dr. Khan, not to be a cynic, but how do you know this? How do you know that they have this different language?
I know this by doing careful experiments. What we would do is we would set up a situation in a prairie dog colony in the wild, and we would haul out our videotape cameras. We'd be huddled in a structure we call a blind that screens us off from the prairie dogs. And then we would either send a particular person out dressed in a particular way, or we would have a dog of a different color and different size walking through the colony. We would record the alarm calls that the prairie dogs make, bring them back into the laboratory, and do careful statistical analysis using very sophisticated statistical programs that then tell us whether the call, say, for a green shirt is the same as or different from a call for a yellow shirt.
So you're actually saying that these animals, they're not colorblind. I always thought like dogs were colorblind.
Well, it sounds like they have really good vision, too, that they're able to distinguish.
They have marvelous vision. For example, one time we saw a dog, a German shepherd, from a long distance away approaching the prairie dog colony. And we noticed that the prairie dogs were making a coyote call. And we were thrilled because finally we caught them out in a mistake. And as the German Shepherd got closer and closer, one of my team looking through the binoculars said, uh-oh. And it turned out it wasn't a German Shepherd. It was a coyote. And the prairie dogs were right, and we were wrong.
Wow. Well, Dr. Khan,
you all have color vision. They do have color vision, and dogs have color vision, and cats have color vision. It's just not exactly the same as ours. They don't have the same kind of receptors for color vision that we do, so they are not experiencing the world exactly the same as we, but they still see colors.
Well, Dr. Khan, let me ask you more about this language, because one of the things I thought was fascinating about your book is that you say prairie dogs talk with nouns and adjectives. I mean, those are really smart animals. Can you explain that a little bit and how you actually know they're talking with nouns and adjectives?
Sure. In a single alarm chirp, you have the equivalent of a sentence. So, for example, if you have a person walking through the colony, the prairie dogs make a call, a chirp, that contains the information that here is a human who is wearing a blue shirt who is walking rapidly through the colony. So human is like a noun, like the subject of a sentence. The blue shirt is like an adjective, or it could be an adverb. And the walking rapidly through the colony is like a verb. So you have a whole sentence included in an alarm chirp that actually takes a tenth of a second. It's a very rapid chirp, and yet the prairie dogs can glean all of the information contained in that. We've also shown that they can also incorporate information about whether that human is carrying a gun or not, and they can also remember up to a couple of months later whether a particular human once had a gun, and they still stick on that label onto that human that he once had a gun.
We're talking with biologist and animal communication specialist Dr. Khan Slobodchikov. His book is called Chasing Dr. Doolittle, Learning the Language of Animals. Dr. Khan, you were talking about how they communicate through nouns and verbs and adjectives, and this is absolutely fascinating. And I'm also very curious as to know, how do they exhibit petty jealousies?
They exhibit petty jealousies by trying to bite at each other, actually. Life in a prairie dog colony is, for the most part, fairly peaceful. They live in well-defined territories. So if you imagine a prairie dog colony is kind of like a subdivision. And within a subdivision, each family or group lives in a house, and maybe that house has a fence around the property. That's kind of like what a prairie dog territory is like, except that they don't have fences. But when neighbors come across the boundary, they will charge at the neighbors and they'll try to attack them. But within the actual territory, within the actual household where the prairie dogs live in the territory, for the most part, they're very peaceful. But occasionally, they do get mad at each other, just like we humans living within a household get mad at each other. And sometimes you'll see a prairie dog snap at another prairie dog. But much of their life is spent actually kissing each other. They come up, they open up their mouths, they press their tongues together and stand there for a couple of seconds doing a French kiss, and then they go happily off on their way. And they'll do that time and again. Males and females will do that to each other. The young will do that to ma and pa. They are very peaceable animals and very loving animals for the most part.
Wow. So do you have any tips for how pet owners can learn the language of their pets? Say I have a dog. How can I learn what he's trying to tell me?
One of the things that's important is to recognize through the awareness of body postures, the frequency changes in the sounds that they make, how to communicate with them. And my suggestion is for your listeners, spend a couple of weeks now with your dog or with your cat or both, and pay attention to the changes in body posture. For example, with a dog, the changes of position of the tail, the changes of position of the ear, how the head either stands up or goes down. With a cat, pay attention to how the tail twitches slowly. Pay attention to when the cat slowly closes her eyes. And then try to do the same thing in the same context and see what happens. And I guarantee you, you will start communicating with your animal doing these simple kinds of things.
Huh. I know when they growl what they're trying to tell me, but not exactly some of the other things they're doing.
Not necessarily, actually. One of the things that I used to do is I used to help people with behavioral problems with their pets.
We were fascinated, Dr. Khan, to read in the New York Times about a study conducted by a Duke University neuroscientist. And, I mean, it really sounded almost like a sci-fi movie in which the brains of two rats were connected via the internet. And one rat was actually in North Carolina, the other in Brazil. And they were actually able to communicate with each other in terms of, I guess, brain connectivity. Can you tell us, in a kind of sum it up for us and tell us, what implication does this have, this type of study?
The implication of this study is that we are starting to understand that our brains are actually radiating out information. Our brains are producing information that other brains can recognize. And we don't know at what distance these brains can recognize, because in this particular study, they had the rats hooked up with electrodes, and then the signal was sent through the internet to another rat that also had electrodes hooked up to its brain, so that the information was going in a very direct way into the brain. But the same researcher also was working with using monkeys sending information from their brain to work a servo prosthetic arm that was in Japan for over a long distance. So what that is showing us is two things. One is that the brain is capable of transmitting more information than we thought at some kind of distance. And the other thing is that we know relatively little about animals and how animals function. And we're starting to scratch the surface of how animals function. And it's the same thing with language, that up until recently, we really didn't think that animals had language. And now we're starting to understand that they have language. So all of these pieces are fitting into the puzzle that animals are much more complex than we've previously given them credit for.
Well, Dr. Khan Slobodjikov, animal communications expert and author of Chasing Dr. Doolittle, I'm going to go outside in my backyard and have a conversation. Thanks so much for joining the Two Boomer Babes.
Thank you.
Up next, the babes shoot the breeze with the genius behind the iconic Etch-A-Sketch. This episode of Two Boomer Babes is sponsored by OnePriceTaxes.com.
Life is full of surprises. Filing your taxes shouldn't be.
One Price Taxes has been making online taxes easy, accurate, and affordable since 2007.
States' returns are included for free. And unlike other filing sites, there are no hidden fees
guaranteed. Support comes from Accent on Travel Rehoboth Beach with a Viking Rhine River cruise with us, the Two Boomer Babes. For questions and reservations, 302-703-6154.
Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. At 6 a.m., I make his breakfast. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. At 6 a.m., I make his breakfast. At 7 a.m., I shower. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. At 6 a.m., I make his breakfast. At 7 a.m., I shower. I start laundry at 8. At 10, we go for a walk. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m.
For those dealing with the daily struggles of caring for a loved one, we hear you. That's why AARP created a community with experts and other caregivers for advice, tips, and support. Together, let's help each other better care for ourselves and the ones we love. Visit aarp.org/caregiving. A public service announcement brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
This is the news. This morning, we are saluting the 2.2 million women who have joined in the war effort. They now make up 37% of the workforce, changing their role forever.
The prestigious Harvard Medical School is breaking ground today, opening its doors to new female applicants.
Today, little girls all over the world look to the sky, where the first woman is now in space.
Military stereotypes are challenged today with the trailblazing promotion of a U.S. female officer to four-star general. It was just announced that the vast majority of last year's doctorate degrees were earned by women.
We've come so far, but our news is changing for the worse. More women die from heart disease and stroke than men, even though it can be prevented. Make a change at GoRedForWomen.org today. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the American Heart Association's Go Red for Women.
Who might you save?
Your mother, your father, your husband, uncle, and son.
Learn FAST, F-A-S-T, the sudden signs of a stroke, and you could save
your friend, your best friend, teacher, boss, coach.
F, face drooping, A, arm weakness, S, speech difficulty, T, time to call 911, F-A-S-T, face, arm, speech, time. That's F, face drooping, A, arm weakness, S, speech difficulty, T, time to call 911. The sooner they get to the hospital, the sooner they'll get treatment. And that can make a remarkable difference in the recovery of
your neighbor, the waiter, a fellow shopper, a total stranger, grandmother, grandfather.
So learn FAST, the sudden signs of a stroke, then pass it on, because you never know who might save you.
Your wife, your colleague, teammate, mother.
Spot a stroke fast. Visit strokeassociation.org. Brought to you by the American Stroke Association and the Ad Council.
The Etch-A-Sketch is a timeless toy. It has wowed kids for more than 50 years. And as young girls, we babes used the magic gadget to draw flowers and rainbows. As we got a bit older, it came in handy to write naughty words during sleepovers.
Which, of course, could be quickly erased.
And our daughters, with their Etch-A-Sketches, repeated this history. What other toy has starred in movies and become a political metaphor in a presidential election?
So when we heard that the inventor of the Etch-A-Sketch, André Cassagne, recently died at the age of 86, it piqued our curiosity. Who was this genius behind the iconic toy? To tell us more is the CEO of the Ohio Art Company, which produced the first Etch-A-Sketch, William Kilgallen. He joins us on the phone from Bryan, Ohio, to shoot the breeze with the babes. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, ma'am.
So tell us a bit about this genius that invented the Etch-A-Sketch.
Well, André was a jovial, rotund individual when I had the pleasure of meeting him in 2006 at his home outside of Paris. He was an inventor. His mind ran in triangles and squares, and that's one of the reasons that he came up with the Etch-A-Sketch concept, and also was the reason that he became a very famous kite builder and was very well known in France.
Now, Bill, not to be nosy, but okay, we are. How much did your company pay for the rights to the Etch-A-Sketch?
I'm not exactly sure, but it was either $15,000 or $25,000 advance.
Now, that's an investment. That's a pretty good investment. Return on your money, I would say.
Well, the initial request, which Mr. Winsler turned down, was $100,000, and in 1959, 1960, that was an awful lot of money.
Right. The Etch-A-Sketch really has not changed much over 50 years, and I just bought one for my niece. It's the same thing that I had, and it certainly is not high-tech in an age when these two-year-olds are playing with their parents' iPads. So why do you think it still appeals to so many kids and adults? I sit there with my niece and play it with her.
You had the Etch-A-Sketch as a child, and you have purchased it for your children and your relatives, and that's certainly one of the strong points. The other strong point is it's something that every child in the world does at one time or another. They scribble, and they show that to their parents or to their teacher, and everybody says, look at that, isn't that wonderful? Well, most people don't know what it is. I think that's the magic of the Etch-A-Sketch. They can scribble between the ages of 2 and 5, and that's exactly what they're supposed to be doing in order to learn how to write.
So it's still popular today.
Very popular.
What were your sales like last year?
Our sales on Etch-A-Sketch were up about 12% from the previous year. We have sold all sizes and all versions, approaching 200 million units.
Wow. Whoa, I would say it's popular.
Now, Bill, I have to ask you this one. Did you think you had absolutely died and gone to heaven when the Etch-A-Sketch was mentioned in the last presidential election by none other than Romney's advisor?
I was down on my knees praying. I didn't get to heaven. But what I was praying for was, I think we were going to make a job offer to the campaign assistant for Mr. Romney.
Oh, I can imagine.
I can only imagine that sales skyrocketed after that.
Well, they didn't actually skyrocket. We did have a nice bump, but it was difficult transferring the magic of the Etch-A-Sketch from a child into the political environment.
Yeah.
And in the political environment, it was really only good as a souvenir. And, of course, we did sell a lot of souvenir-type Etch-A-Sketches. And that campaign, which was created along with our internal staff by Team Detroit, is up for an Effie Award.
Well, congrats to you.
And we will know in May whether or not we win the grand prize.
William Kilgallen, chairman of the Ohio Art Company, thanks so much for shooting the breeze with the two Boomer Babes.
You're welcome, Barb and Kathy. Thank you for having me on your program.
This episode of Two Boomer Babes is sponsored by OnePriceTaxes.com.
Life is full of surprises. Filing your taxes shouldn't be.
OnePriceTaxes has been making online taxes easy, accurate, and affordable since 2007.
States' returns are included for free. And unlike other filing sites, there are no hidden fees
guaranteed. Support comes from Accent on Travel, Rehoboth Beach, with a Viking Rhine River cruise with us, the Two Boomer Babes. For questions and reservations, 302-703-6154. And now it's time for us babes to give credit where credit is due.
Audio and technical guru Julio Gonzalez, who magically pulls it all together.
Webmaster wizard Gail Jane, who makes twoboomerbabes.com a fab place to visit.
Founding members of the Chicago chapter of the Two Boomer Babes Supper Club, Mike and Larry Israel, for your unfailing love and support.
Our husbands, daughters, family, and friends, even with smirks and eye rolls, who encourage us all the way.
And give us great material, often without knowing it.
Our moms and upstairs directors, Jane and Sally, who are cheering us on from their bridge game in the sky.
Our home away from home, Delmarva Public Radio. And to you, our listeners, for joining us each week and spurring us on.
Two Boomer Babes is a production of Two Boomer Babes Media in collaboration with Zimer Communications.
Who might you save?
Your mother, your father, your husband, uncle, aunt, son.
Learn FAST, F-A-S-T, the sudden signs of a stroke, and you could save
your friend, your best friend, teacher, boss, coach.
F, face drooping, A, arm weakness, S, speech difficulty, T, time to call 911. F-A-S-T, face, arm, speech, time. That's F, face drooping, A, arm weakness, S, speech difficulty, T, time to call 911. The sooner they get to the hospital, the sooner they'll get treatment. And that can make a remarkable difference in the recovery of
your neighbor, the waiter, a fellow shopper, a total stranger, grandmother, grandfather.
So learn FAST, the sudden signs of a stroke, then pass it on, because you never know who might save you.
Your wife, your colleague, teammate, mother.
Spot a stroke fast. Visit strokeassociation.org. Brought to you by the American Stroke Association and the Ad Council.